Wow, awesome job. You know that's a hard song to sing. Thank you, Sarah and Ben. You know, Adele, maybe you've experienced that in the last week. I mean, maybe you've been on the other end of some of those words. Take a look. I don't know if you caught the backup vocals there. Look at these. It says, "You're going to wish you'd never met me. Tears are going to fall." All right, now that's somebody that's going out looking for somebody right there, all right? "You're going to wish you never met me. Tears are going to fall, rolling in the deep." And so, here's the reality. When we talk about difficult people, here's the bad part of today right here, all right? When we're talking about difficult people. Dealing with difficult people is unavoidable. All right, I hate to break the bad news to you, but they are all over life. In every aspect, every segment of life, you're going to encounter difficult people. And at least if you live in the real world, all right, if you're living in some magical fairy tale land, you may not experience them. I'm going to bring you back to reality right now. If you're living in the real world, you're going to deal with difficult people. And then here's the second part of that, which is, I don't know, it's kind of equally bad. And that is that, you don't just deal with them once. But you're going to deal with them over and over and over again. I mean, they may not be the same person. It may not be the same person that you're interacting with that's causing you to struggle, but they're going to be at every point in life. And so, one of the things I want us to look at today is, how do we deal with people like this? And here's the reality. We're taking a look at difficult religious people. And there's a really fine line here, because you don't have to be somebody that's religious to be a difficult religious person. All right. If in many cases, maybe what we're going to look at today is more along the lines of, how can I prevent becoming one of those difficult religious people? So let's go after this today. Let's pray first. God, I'm thankful today that we can come into this room, this dark room, and we can hear things that we can't really learn or see or hear in many other sectors of our culture. That, people are an important piece of our life, God. And in fact, people are an important piece of this whole creation that you put into motion. And so, God, today as we gather in this room, I'm going to ask that as a result of our time in this room, God, that you would in some way reveal something to us. That you would help us to see something that maybe we've never seen before. Maybe there's some things that we've understood and that we've been about before, but they've just got layered over and covered up, and we need to unpack those again today. And so I ask, God, that you would meet us here in this place. We come from different spiritual orientations, different backgrounds. And yet one of the things we know is that when we gather here, in some way, we're looking to meet you. And the reality is, as much as we may be coming here to see you in some way, you come here to meet us. And so I'd pray, God, that happens in some unique way, that you would use me in whatever way you see fit. And I'd pray these things in your name and according to your character. Amen. I was recently reading an article. It was really fascinating, in fact. It was talking about the amount of money that we here in America spend every year on cosmetic touch-ups. It was quite fascinating. In fact, the general American public spends over $10 billion a year simply making cosmetic touch-ups to our bodies. The American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery reports that almost 9.5 million cosmetic procedures were done in 2010, and surgical procedures accounted for 17% of that total. And it said basically that overall, the number of cosmetic procedures increased 155% since the tracking of statistics first began back in 1997. Now, I don't know why this stood out to me. I don't know why this grabbed my attention, but it said something to me. What was more interesting is the demographic age group of people who most engage or use cosmetic touch-ups, and that's the age group of 35 to 50. In fact, 44% of the $10 million that was spent in the last year was spent by people between 35 and 50, which some up about 4 million procedures in the last year. And as I was reading this, I thought, this is kind of a summary statement of where our culture is at. We like cosmetic touch-ups, right? I mean, we like to say, well, I'm not going to change everything. I'm just going to change the surface and make it look a little bit different. And yet the reality is, cosmetic touch-ups, they never really solve the core of the problem. All right, they don't solve the fact that we're getting older, right? I mean, they don't solve the fact, as I've noticed, I'm getting bags under my eyes. Botox, it just gives you the impression that I look better than I do, right? I mean, we like to cosmetically kind of touch ourselves up. And it's not just a physical thing. It's something we do with our finances as well, right? We find ourselves with way too much month left at the end of our money and a number of months in a row. And what do? We're like, man, I've got to get to the core of this thing. And then we say, well, I found a solution. I'm going to get another loan. I'm going to put all of this together, and I'm just going to borrow more money so that I don't have to pay, as many payments out at one time. Instead of addressing the core of the issue, let me just let you in on a little secret. Getting a loan does not solve your spending habits. All right? It doesn't create a solution there. It's just a cosmetic touch-up. Where I come from, And maybe you've probably never done this before. People around you have never done this before. But where I come from, you know, if somebody needed a shower, they'd just be like, oh, I'm just going to go put some deodorant on. You ever done that before? And you're like, oh, I stink. I mean, I need a shower. And so I'm just going to touch up right here real quick. And all of a sudden, it's like I'm going to cover it up and it's all better, right? I mean, it's one of those small little tiny cosmetic little things we do to try to cover up and, maybe a deeper issue. Here's one you'll really connect with, I think. Here's one that maybe strikes at the core for some of us. And that's that I don't care what kind of shoes you're wearing, they are not going to make you a better athlete. All right, think about that. Julie and I took our son down to the Colts-Packers game, which is a great first half, by the way, on Friday night. And while we were down there, he kept watching Dwight Freeney. He's like, Dad, do they sell Dwight Freeney's shoes at Dick's? And I'm like, Matthew, those shoes will not make you a better defensive end. I mean, contrary to what Michael Jordan tried to teach us, contrary to what Tiger Woods tells us, you know, wearing the shoes doesn't make you a better athlete. And yet, the reality is, we put all of this energy and effort into making these small little cosmetic changes, and yet they never get to the core of the issue. And as we kind of begin to unpack difficult people today, I think the way we handle people is often the same. You know, when dealing with difficult people, you know, we like to get advice and tips, right? We're like, I want a few pieces of advice. If you came looking for advice today, you're gonna end, you know, sad. Because I don't have advice for you today, you know. Why do you think we look for advice? We come like, man, I want a few tips. I want a little advice on how to do this. I think we do that because, you know, it's easy to get advice and tips, but we really have to go deeper. And most of us don't want to go deeper and really look at what does it mean for me to change my heart on this matter. And so we come to church, we're like, man, I just want a few tips. Give me a few walkaways where I can go and implement one little thing and maybe change the way something looks. But today I want to talk about what it means to get to the core. And because, you know, difficult people show up in life, in every aspect of life. It's when you don't expect it. And when difficult people show up, it reveals the true person that you really are. I don't know, 6, 8 months ago, 10 months ago, Julie and I, we were flying to a conference, and we had our youngest daughter with us, maybe it was about a year ago, had our youngest daughter with us because she wasn't quite able to stay home with her brothers and sisters, and so we took her with us, and Julie was just kind of going along to take some downtime while I was at this conference. And so, you know, we left one evening and went to the airport, and, you know, we were rushed to get there. Maybe you've had this experience, you're rushed to get there, you're stressed, like we're going to miss our flight, only to check in and find out that they just delayed it like 2.5 hours. You sit around, you know, fretting for 2.5 hours about how you're going to be late, and then finally, you know, we get to 2.5 hours, and it's delayed another hour, so it's now like 9:30, and we're struggling. There's a guy that gets arrested in front of me at the counter because he's telling them what they're going to do and where they're taking their computers and all kinds of stuff, and, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, Kurt, keep your cool, and so, you know, we find out we're going to get out just in time to catch our connecting flight in Atlanta, and we did. We got out just in time, only to get to Atlanta and find out we're delayed another 3 hours from there, which means that, you know, we thought we'd get in to have like 5 or 6 hours of sleep. If everything goes according to plan from this point, we might get a 3-hour nap before I have to get up and into the conference. So, you know, we finally get to our destination, and, you know, I go down to get the rental car and show up at the rental counter. And of course, we have our daughter with us who's about 11 months at the time. And you know, I rented a car seat, right? That's a logical thing to do. And it's 2 in the morning. The guy says, well, sir, we don't have any car seats clean for you. And I'm like, well, what do you want me to do? He's like, well, we've steam cleaned a few. They're dripping wet over here, but you could take one and you could put her in it and change her clothes when you get to your hotel. Now, at 10 o'clock, I may have taken that. All right, but at 2:30, 3 in the morning, let me be honest. In that scenario, tips and advice don't cut it. All right, tips and advice on how to handle yourself. The real Kurt comes through right there, all right? And so, you know, as we look at difficult people today, I want us to think about, you know, are we looking for tips and advice, or we really want to get deeper to the core of what it means to be changed people? I want us to ask a couple questions. Meaning, you know, are we looking for tips and advice, or do we really want to change? We really want to say, I want to grow in this area of my life. You know, personally, I believe every word that's written in this book right here. You know, I've read this book cover to cover a couple times. I've read certain parts of this book hundreds of times. And yet I'm always amazed at how when I read certain parts of it, there are certain things that just totally jump off the page to me. And it's like, I've never read that before. And maybe it hits me a little differently, but I'm amazed. As I was kind of reading and preparing for today, I thought, you know, there's a couple things here that you know, Jesus talks about difficult people. I mean, this is a really big issue to him. He gives us some great examples of how to go through, how do we handle difficult people. And so we find in the book of Luke, which is in the New Testament, and Luke is one of four writers. You have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they're all writing about Jesus' life, and they're the first four books of the New Testament. And basically, they're writing what they see. They're giving you a written account of what they observed and watched. And they're all different human beings, so they're catching it and sharing it a bit differently, but it's amazing how they line up. This is why these are some of the most historically accurate books that exist today. And so here's what it says in Luke 6, verse 27. It says, "But to you who are listening, I say." Now, I want to stop right there for a moment because, you know, Jesus is speaking right here to people that are listening. All right, he's speaking to people that are listening. And I point this out because, you know, I often don't make assumptions about what kind of people walk in the doors here at Crosspoint every week. We don't make assumptions about what kind of biblical knowledge you have, what kind of biblical background you have, what kind of faith background you have. We realize we have people that walk in from broad spectrums of faith and God and church, and we start at square one. And yet at the same time, I know that when someone shows up in this place, usually you're looking for some kind of answer or direction. Jesus is saying right here, "But to you who are listening, I say." And I point this out because, you know, I think a lot of times we show up and we don't really want to listen. I'm not talking listen to Kurt. I'm talking, this is Jesus saying, if you want to listen to me, I'm ready to tell you something right here. He says, "Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Pick at those who disagree with you. Fight those who have different opinions than you." If somebody has a politically different opinion, just slander them all you want. Is that what you see right here? I mean, come on. That's what we wish it said, right? I mean, that's if we were like, if I could write that over right there, that's what I would say. No. He says, "Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those that curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you." Let me tell you what, that's hard. That is hard. I don't know if anybody finds that easy. This is why I love Jesus. This is what I love about Jesus. He's not playing some religious game where he's like, "Hey, I'm going to give you a couple tips, a little bit of advice to implement in a difficult moment." He's like, "I'm going for the hard. This is hard. Change the core of who you are kind of stuff right here." You see, you and I, we want tips that kind of are a response to the symptoms we're experiencing in life without getting to the core problem. And here's the deal. Here's what's really fascinating. You know what the one common denominator is in dealing with difficult people? You're going to be surprised. It's you, all right? It's you and me. The one common denominator in all of your interactions with difficult people is you. It's me. It's, you know, we are a part of that scenario. And so, you know, the reality is we can't fix them. We can't change them. All we can do is say, you know, how am I going to respond in this situation? How am I going to grow in this situation? You're thinking, "Man, Kurt, I've been trying to do good. I've been trying to love the people that hate me. I've been trying to do the perfect thing in these scenarios." Let me be honest. Jesus is not asking for perfection right here. Nowhere in these words do we hear perfection. All God's looking for is that we're heading in the right direction, that we're growing through these encounters, and there's something happening in us that's taking us to a new place. I mean, this is what I love about Jesus. Here's another reality that I've realized right here, and that's that our beliefs often drive our behaviors. What we begin to believe about a person or those little things that begin to stick out to us, we become so focused on those things that we fail to see the bigger picture of what's going on. I don't know if you've ever experienced that before. Let me help us do that here real quick. I've got something really fun I want you to do. I'm going to show you a video in just a moment. And this is a video of a basketball team. And we're going to love it, of course, because we're in Indiana, right? We love basketball around here. So this is a video. And there's a white team and there's a black team. And I want you to count the number of passes the white team makes. All right? It's very fast. It moves quick. There's people moving. So you've got to pay really close attention. In fact, I want you to get comfortable in your seats right now. All right? So go ahead and get comfortable. If you need to slouch down, however you watch TV, make that posture right now, all right? Get comfortable. Count the number of passes the white team, yeah, I see a few of you moving, the white team makes, all right? Now, it's fast. I'm going to warn you. It's going to start, and it's going to go right into it, all right? Are we ready? Got the lights down. Here we go. Count. All right, so it's test time, all right? I'm putting the paper in front of you. How many, what was your number? Just shout a couple numbers out.
14.
15. 28. Were you guys watching the same video? Come on. I mean, this is like double the numbers right here. All right. All right. Did anybody notice anything unusual by chance during the middle of the video? Raise your hand if you saw something unusual. All right. If you didn't see something unusual, raise your hand real tall. All right. Now, no liars in the room. Raise your hand real tall. All right. Yeah, not as many of us. Okay. So those of you, just raise your hands. You did not see the gorilla that walked through the middle of that screen while you were counting, did you? See, this is always interesting. This is not about the number of passes right here, all right? You know, and you don't believe me that there was a gorilla, do you? All right, these same image, watch on both screens. Same image on both screens. Let's roll it again. Watch this. He even does a move for you. He even pounds his chest right in the middle just for you. All right, here he comes. He's getting ready to enter right here. I know some of you are really embarrassed right now. Here's the deal. You know, this shows us that this is actually called selective attention. It means that, you know, you and I, we can get so focused on one thing. We see something we don't like in somebody. Somebody just turns us the wrong way. We become so focused on that one personality trait that we fail to see the rest of what's going on in a scenario. We miss the big picture. I mean, it's amazing. That's why in a room of, you know, this size, 120 people or so, we can see totally different things. You can have the same conversation with somebody, the same encounter, and you can see two totally separate things. I mean, it's amazing. And it reminds us, you know, as we deal with difficult people, sometimes we only see the tip of the iceberg. You familiar with the tip of the iceberg concept? You know, 90% of the iceberg out in the ocean is underwater. When you and I deal with people, when you come across somebody that's abrasive, somebody who just turns you the wrong way, somebody who maybe has personality traits that you don't connect with, usually what you're seeing is about 10% of their life. There's about 90% left underneath the surface. And we have to ask the question, how do I interact with this person? When I see this, when I experience this, when it turns me on, I'm like, man, I can't stand that. Am I able to see that maybe there's more going on right here than just what I'm seeing or experiencing? I mean, it's a fascinating concept. You know, and when it comes to dealing with difficult people, difficult religious people, what we believe, what we choose to see drives our response. So three big ideas today, and these are not tips. These are harder than tips and advice. These are things that I think will help us maybe begin to allow our hearts to maybe see people through a different lens, and maybe in some cases help us not become the difficult religious people that we actually hate interacting with. All right, so here's the first one. First big idea is that God is gracious and does not repay in kind. I mean, this is a good thing. This means that God is gracious to you, just because you screw up, God does not treat you that same way. Take a look at what the writer Luke says here in Luke chapter 6. He says, "But love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be the children of the Most High God, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked." Doesn't say he's kind to those who do good. He doesn't say he's kind only to those who do the right thing. He says he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. God is gracious. He doesn't give us what we deserve. I mean, think about this. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand on this, but think for a moment in your mind. Have you ever had one of those conversations with God where you're like, God, man, God, if you could just extend me grace one more time on this scenario right here. I mean, I know, God, I know I'm trying to work this deal out in my life right here. I know I've come to you about this before. I know I've struggled with this issue right here before. But God, could you just one more time, could you not allow me to experience the kind of consequence that I deserve in this scenario? Could you just be graceful with me and extend me grace? Don't raise your hand. Ask yourself, have you had that kind of conversation before? I mean, that's why we sing around here. That's why we sing these songs about grace and God's goodness, about, you know, there's a God that came and lowered himself down, not because you're good. He didn't do it because you're good. He simply did it because Jesus died on the cross. I mean, sometimes we begin to get in this mentality that God is graceful to me because I deserve it. Here's the problem right here. We often believe God will give us grace for us, but that God is not going to give grace to someone else, right? And we believe, God, man, God, I deserve your grace. Man, I'm good. I go to church. I put something in the joy box. I serve people. Yeah, I mean, I do all these things. I do all the right things. I'm a do-gooder. God, I deserve this. But man, that loser over there, they don't deserve that. You need to teach them a lesson right there. I mean, how many times did we do that? And don't tell me you didn't. All right? It's like when you're speeding down the highway and somebody just blows by you faster than you're going. You're like, man, I sure hope there's a police officer around the corner. I mean, you're like, come on. You're like, you want grace, but the person that just didn't blew by you, you're like, well, they deserve to have a lesson taught right here, right? I mean, this is the deal. And here's the thing. Here's the thing. People that have encountered the grace of God, I mean, here's what I've learned. Are often the most generous people I know to other people. And I'm not talking generous with their bank accounts. They probably are that too. I'm not talking generous with their time, though they probably are that as well. I'm talking they're the most generous, grace-giving people to other people that I've ever experienced. And it's not because they feel like they're better than everybody else. It's not because they went to church. It's not because they read their Bible every day. Or, you know, it's not because of any of these things. It's simply because they've got the picture. They've understood that the only reason that they have grace is because Jesus died on the cross. You see, God does not repay in kind. He says, I want you to give the kind of grace that you ask for. I want you to repay that to others, that same kind of grace. Second big thing we have to grasp, we have to let really sink in and begin to change how we think, is that we have to realize that people are created in God's image. Take a look at this. The scripture writer in Genesis 1:27, one of my favorite verses. This is kind of a poetic refrain when God's putting everything into motion here in planet Earth as we know it. And this poet's kind of refraining what happened. It says, so God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And what I love about this is saying that you and I are divine image bearers. This is saying that when God blew breath into your lungs, when he picked up the dirt off the ground and blew breath into the lungs of Adam and asked Adam to reproduce and become a great nation, when this happened, he said, I'm going to place my image. You're going to reflect the very image and nature of who God is. You become a divine image bearer. Here's the bad news. That difficult person that you've been thinking about all morning, they are a divine image bearer of God as well. I mean, how would our interactions change with them if every person we interacted with, we said, you know, this person is a divine image bearer of the living God, the God who put the heavens into place, who created molecules and atoms and things like rhinoceroses. I mean, how would I view them differently? I mean, every human being has intrinsic value. Here's the deal. I have 4 little kids that run around this place here at Cross Point. They get into trouble every now and then. One son and 3 girls. And some of you have to correct them at times. You're in classes. You're a volunteer serving in their rooms, you know, somewhere. And here's the deal. They need to be corrected every now and then. If you have my permission, if you see them, to correct them if you feel like they're out of line. The only thing I'd ask is one thing, that you do it in a way that maintains your dignity and in a way that maintains their dignity. Think about that. With every person we interact with, including my children, I'm giving you permission, do it in a way that maintains your dignity and their dignity. We have this intrinsic value because we're divine image bearers. Take a look at what Paul says in Romans chapter 21, or chapter 12. He says, do not overcome evil by evil, but overcome evil with good. Let me be honest with you. I struggle with this right here. I struggle with this. You know why I struggle with this? Because I like to win. I mean, you can ask my kids, man. When we were playing kickball in the backyard 3 nights ago, I had to kick the ball 3 houses down just because I like to win. I mean, when we were racing scooters in the cul-de-sac, man, I'm blazing around because I like to win. I don't care if they're 4. I still like to win. And I somehow, in my mind, I get this reality, this idea that, you know, I got to win at all costs. Why? When I'm in situations with people, I say I have to win at all costs because I'm right and God, of course, loves me more, right? I mean, he loves me way more than he loves you. I mean, God's happy. And so I have to win at all costs just to show everybody else that I'm right and they're wrong. I mean, you notice how we do these amazing things in our relationships? And what's amazing is that Jesus never did that. Nowhere in scriptures does God overcome evil with evil. In fact, we see this one scenario of this in John chapter 8. And Jesus is teaching, and he's you know, wherever Jesus is, I mean, he's like the greatest show on earth. I mean, people are being attracted to him. Wherever he goes, people gather and they want to hear him. You know why they want to hear him? Because he just makes sense of the scriptures. He begins to teach things and it applies to their life. People actually get it. And so he's sitting down at the synagogue, at the temple in this case. He's getting ready to teach people. And the Pharisees are the religious leaders of the day. These are kind of the difficult religious people of people's lives in this particular day. They are attracted to Jesus as well. Now, they may be attracted for different reasons than everyone else, but they are coming to hear what Jesus has to say. Somewhere along the way, as they're heading to meet Jesus at the synagogue, they come across a woman who's caught in what it says adultery. adultery is simply she's having some kind of sexual experience with somebody who's not her husband. And it's not enough for them to just you know, confront her or even maybe extend her some grace. They have to find out why it's bad. They have to take everything off the top. In fact, they make her come with them. They drag her across town. They bring her into the synagogue, and they literally place her in front of Jesus. And here's where we pick the story up in John chapter 8. It says, they made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say?" Now, obviously, there's a lot going on right here. I mean, these religious leaders, they're trying to pin Jesus. They're actually trying to determine how he's going to interpret the law here. But here's the deal. Jesus is the smartest guy that ever lived. That's what I love about Jesus. He knows exactly what to do in this scenario. You know what he begins to do? He gets down on his knees, and he begins to just simply draw in the sand. That's what it says. It says he begins to draw with his finger in the sand. Now, we don't know what he's drawing. And wouldn't you have loved to see his art? I mean, wouldn't you have loved to see what words he's drawing? All it says, he's drawing in the sand. And again, Jesus is the smartest guy that ever lived. Maybe what he's doing, he's realizing how just absolutely afraid and dejected this woman must feel. And so he's trying to take the attention off her and to bring it upon himself. So he just gets down and begins to draw. Eventually, it says he straightens back up and he looks up at them and he says, "Well, here's my response. If any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." And then again, he stooped down and he just wrote on the ground. Brilliant. Brilliant. He says, "Hey, if there's anybody that hasn't sinned, then go ahead, pick a stone up. If you're perfect, go ahead, be the first one." And then he just begins to write again. I mean, you know what I think he was doing? I have a feeling he was writing the names of the men that brought her to him and just beginning to very indiscreetly kind of list out all of the sins in their lives, revealing to them, "Hey, if you want to start making lists, I can make some lists. Let me show you a list right here." I have a feeling that's what he was doing. And you know what it goes on to say then? It says, one by one, beginning with the oldest all the way down to the youngest, they began to walk away. And that's significant. It's significant because, you know, those who are older, the older I get, I'm much more aware of all of the sin that I've committed in my life. I mean, you know, the older you are, the more propensity you have had to sin. And so he says, "Hey, if you're without sin," and it says the oldest began to walk away all the way down to the youngest. He looked up at the woman. He said, "Woman, where have your accusers gone?" And she looked around. She said, they're not here anymore. And you know what he said to her? All he said was, "Hey, go live in grace and don't sin anymore." That's all he said. He didn't remind her of all the ways she did it wrong. He didn't remind. All he did was say, "Go and just don't do this anymore." That is not normal. That is not a normal response. That's not how I usually respond. Which leads me to the third point. Third way that we really begin to change at the core, not just the symptoms. Which is that empowerment comes from being connected to God. How do we begin to respond this way, even in the most difficult of situations, with the most difficult of people, even with the most difficult of religious people? Jesus says empowerment comes from being connected to God. A few years ago, again, I was getting ready to board an airplane. It's funny how you run into a lot of difficult people on airplanes. And, you know, we were heading someplace and got on the plane. And as I got down to my seat, you know, I don't know if you're this way. When I sit on an airplane, I have a decision to make. I have to decide, do I want to talk to the person next to me or do I not? All right, and so if I want to talk to them, usually it's like, "Hey, how you doing? Good, good. Where are you going? You know, you're on business vacation." And then it goes, "Well, what do you do?" Well, if I want to talk, I'll say something like, "Well, I'm involved in community transformation. And they'll say, "Oh, wow, that's interesting. Tell me more about that." And I'll say, "Well, I'm like a coach. I'm a mentor. You know, I coach people on how to live, how to make decisions." And they're interested in more. If I don't want to talk to somebody, I'll just simply say, "Hey, I'm a pastor. I believe there's a literal hell and people still go there." And immediately, it'll end the conversation. I mean, it's done. I'm done. Nobody will talk to me the rest of the trip. So I have to make a decision. Am I going to talk to anybody? I look over. This woman is like sitting next to me and she's fidgeting. She's jittery in her seat. And she looks at me. She says, "Have you ever done this before?" I'm like, "Well, like the seatbelt, the tray, like what are we talking about here?" She's like, "Well, have you ever flown?" And I'm like, well, yeah, it's fun. I love to fly, you know. And as we start talking, and I get very clearly that this is her first flight. I mean, she must be like in her 50s, first time she's ever been on an airplane. And so You know, we're taxiing out to the runway, and I remember, back around 9/11, they were talking about is flying more safe than driving in cars, and I remember a pilot saying, you know, it's just the first 60 seconds and the last 60 seconds. I mean, everything can go wrong in the first 60 seconds, everything can go wrong in the last 60 seconds, everything in the middle, you know, it's pretty easy, kind of like coasting. So, you know, it's just like 747's barreling down the runway. I look at her, like, shivering over there, and I'm like, you know, I didn't say this to her. I said, I thought, ma'am, you know, it's only the next 60 seconds that we could, like, die. I mean, that's all you have to be worried about. But I realized that probably wasn't going to make her day any better. And so I just sat there, just listen, just, you know. But as I was thinking about this, I thought, you know, she's onto something right here, right? She's onto something. It's not normal for a steel tube, 250 feet long, filled with people and luggage, to be catapulting through the air at 550 miles an hour. I mean, that's not normal. It goes against a law called gravity, right? And the law of gravity is a pretty significant thing. When the law of gravity is in effect, things fall, and it usually isn't good. And so, you know, I'm thinking about this. I'm like, man, she's onto something. This isn't normal. It's the first time. It's not normal. And then I begin to realize there's another law in play right here. It's the law of aerodynamics. And the law of aerodynamics is a higher law than even the law of gravity. And I realized that, you know, while we're in a steel tube with a whole bunch of people and all of this luggage, and this isn't normal, we also have these two things called jet engines attached to this tube that propel us forward in an amazing way. And they actually create this experience to be reasonably smooth and normal. Unless we lose the two engines. And then we're all, it's like downhill from there. As I'm thinking about this, I realize, I'm thinking, you know, so many times we try to deal with difficult people with no power. I mean, we're just like a steel tube catapulted through the air with no power. I mean, we think, man, I can do this on my own. I just need a few tips, a little bit of advice, as opposed to getting connected to Jesus and allowing Jesus to begin to change our hearts and change our understandings and to look at people not for their behavior, but for who they belong to. And this isn't my words, these are Jesus' words. Take a look here in John chapter 15. He says, I am the vine, you are the branches. Those who remain in me and I in them will produce much fruit, for apart from me, you can pretty much do anything you want. That's not what it says, is it? Apart from me, you can do what you want some of the time. No. He says, from apart from me, you can do nothing. And yet we're amazed. We're amazed that when we interact with people that we have no power, because we're not connected to the one who actually provides it. And so as we wrap this up this morning, I realize, you know, that for many of us, we're looking for tips, advice, we're looking for, what's a couple things we can implement? Well, you know, I want you to take out your connection card, and we filled these out earlier. On the back side are some next steps. And, you know, it's not enough to just come into this room once or twice and say, oh, I'm going to get a handle on a couple things and go do this. No, you have to be connected to the power source. That's how you are equipped to do things that are not normal. Not normal responses in difficult situations. And so, you know, this upcoming week, I want you to think, you know, as I'm thinking about interacting with somebody who may be difficult, there's a number of next steps on the back of this card, and I just want to walk you through them real quick. And these aren't for us. This is for you. I mean, I'd hate for you to come into this room and just, you know, hear a few things, be like, man, that's good, walk out and not think about this anymore. I mean, we care way too much about you to allow that to happen. So I want to give you some very tangible things you can begin to do to create some of the change that maybe God can bring to take you to new places in your relationships. For some of us, maybe you say, man, this is connected with me. Maybe I'm not ready to just kind of say I'm all in on this thing, but something's connected here, and I want to come back each of the next 2 weeks and continue to see if God doesn't do something inside of me as we continue to impact dealing with difficult people. Maybe that's your step. Maybe this week you need to have an open, honest conversation with God about a difficult person in your life. Maybe they've been on your mind all morning. And you need to say, God, you know, help me to really understand my attitude in this relationship, because you are one of the two players. Just ask God, and then listen. See what God may say to you. Maybe you need to become that person that is more graceful, less asking for grace and more grace-giving, and being a person of grace in a difficult relationship. Maybe you have been the difficult religious person that nobody wants to interact with, and you're like, man, maybe I need to begin to allow grace to just kind of resonate in me so I can be that person to others. Or maybe you know you've been at the point of creating some very, very harmful, damaging, deteriorating things, whether through your words, your behaviors, in a relationship, and you just need to confess that.
and say, Jesus, I need some grace right here. And the only way for this to begin to change and for me to begin to change, it begins with grace. If that's where you are, you can invite Christ to do that today, and it's free. It's right there. It's waiting for you. So I want you to take a few moments and just reflect. Say, God, what's my next step? What's the thing that's not just a tip I'm going to implement, but what do I need to do? What are you saying that I need to do as I walk out of here today so I can become more of the person that you've created me to be? We're going to sing.